Okay, it's 9 o'clock, so we're going to start now. People coming on, they'll be coming on, but I want to start. Before I get to continue where we were last week, Rabbi Yecheskel Abramsky, just a few more things that have been sent to me and things I've seen. We've dealt with many rabbis. I think there's over 130, 135 talks online now, and a number of the ones we've dealt with, new material has appeared. For example, an autobiography of Rav Shlomo Gorin, I have it here somewhere, I don't see it now, appeared a few months ago. This book just appeared. It's called Gevurot Eliyahu. It's quite a big thing, which has all sorts of new material from Rav Henkin, the famous Rav Henkin. So obviously, if I was doing the classes on him now, I'd incorporate a lot of it, but I'm not going to go back just because there's new material. But let me just tell you about one interesting thing in here. He's asked if he speaks about getting an aliyah in shul. Here's going to be an example, I think, of something which makes perfect sense, but will never be done because it goes against the practice. In fact, he says himself it goes against it. We know that the sages made a decree or an ordinance, takana, that on Shabbos, seven people are called up to the Torah, and originally those people would do the laning. They would read it themselves. And that is the takana. However, later on, it was changed, and because not everyone knew how to read it, that the reader, the Baal Kore, he himself reads it. So Rav Henkin points out that the problem with this is that, well, I don't want to get into the details. He says that the whole idea of the of a Kohen going first and a Levi going second is precisely because they would be called to read it. But now that they're not reading it, they're just getting the Aliyah, he doesn't think that it makes any sense at all that a Kohen and a Levi need to be called first. He says that lecharchila, you know, no one's going to change this, but he doesn't think that the kohanim in koach hakohanim litvoazeh, you know, they can't actually demand it, and he doesn't think that it's really that there's any concept of giving an aliyah first to a kohen. He says a number of other things if they're not reading it, because as I said, originally they were supposed to read it for themselves, and he says a number of other important things. This, for those who have the book, is number 40. But then at the end, after saying that he can't, you know, you're not going to get rid of giving Cohen and Levy first, even though he doesn't see any reason for it, he does speak about something that if he had the authority, he would get rid of. And I guess he does have the authority in his show. And that's the Misha Berachs. He says that originally, the only person who got a Misha Berach was someone who gave tzedakah. And he says that's if you look at it in the Misha Berach, when we call people up, at least the classic version is, because they give tzedakah. However, he says that this idea that everyone is called up and everyone gets an aliyah, he says it doesn't make any more sense. And he thinks it's actually a bizayon, a disgrace to the Torah. Why does he think that? Because he says someone gets an aliyah, is called up, and we give them a Misha Berach ba'avor sh'ala la Torah. We give someone a Misha Berach that he came up to the Torah. And he says, what kind of thing is this? That We're giving a bracha to this person who got an aliyah because, as it were, he did a great chesed. He did something for us. He did something for the Torah by getting an aliyah. Why is that? Ba'avor shalala Torah. How does the Torah benefit? Or how does anyone benefit because he got an aliyah? So therefore he says, and he says the fact that now we make a Misha Berach for the Gabbaim and everyone else, he says this, that's for Nesias Kapayim, that the Kohen, for example, gives a bracha to people. But there's no concept, he says. He says, if I had the strength, I would go back to the old custom and only give a Misha Berach to those people who give money, but not to anyone else. And as I said, there's other interesting things. He talks also about a katan, an under bar mitzvah boy being called up. So those who have the book, as I said, it's Simon Mem. Number 40. Two other things before we start. Oh, we have lots of good stuff today. We did classes on Rav Meir Simcha of Dvinsk, the famous Meshech Chachma. And during the break, between the last time we were here and this time, I was reading through the Meshech Chachma, and I saw something very interesting in Achrei Mos, in the Parsha of Achrei Mos. He's wondering why in the prophets, the Nevi'im, there's no mention of Yom Kippur. I mean, they talk about all sorts of things. They wouldn't mention Yom Kippur. Shabbos is mentioned. And he says that, in a sense, Yom Kippur, everyone I think who's been listening for years knows my vort about that Yom Kippur is the, I mean, we have to do it and everything. Although I do say that as I get older, I have more appreciation for it. But I always say that, you look at the Pew survey, everyone's trying to figure out, conservative Judaism, its great decline and everything. Reform Judaism, I think, as I've said, I know they hate me for saying this, but high holiday services actually cause the movement to a certain extent its collapse, because if people are only going to synagogue twice a year, three times a year, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, if those are the times you go where you have to sit through a long service, a boring service, and you're told you have to fast, I mean, that's what your idea of Judaism is. It's asceticism to sit in the synagogue all day. If that's all you know it is, and we all know plenty of people who that's all it has, it's no wonder that, if they were brought for shul when they were young, and this is what they saw when they get older, they have no interest in that whatsoever. If they want anything, it'll be a new age, one of these new age type of Judaisms. But so, as I've said, if it was up to me, I'd actually cancel high holiday services, and instead you can have them come on Sukkot or Simchas Torah or Purim or anything like that. Truthfully, have them come on Shabbos. We know that Shabbos is more important than Yom Kippur. There are certain things we do on Yom Kippur because it's supposed to be done once a year. But Shabbos, one of the reasons we know is that you have more aliyahs on Shabbos. The onesh, the punishment is more. But just in terms from simple utilitarianism, I truly believe, and I've seen this in my lifetime among people I know, others as well, that the high holiday services, which many people feel they have to go for nostalgia or other things, it's a big turnoff. And if people are going to come to shul twice a year, that's the wrong time to bring them to shul. Like I said, we go to shul, so we know that none of us would be going to shul if every week was like that. But once a year, twice a year, this is a special time to reflect. I have other things to say about the Pew survey, but not for now. In any event, so he asks, so why isn't Nevi'im mentioned there? And he says, because there's nothing, why isn't Yom Kippur mentioned? He says there's nothing about Yom Kippur that has what he calls a hergesh le'umi. There's no national element of Yom Kippur. And if the prophets are all about national ideas. He says, kikuam hayub moshvot tam. Everyone in Yom Kippur was at their home. And it's a fast day for once a year is not a big deal. And the Kohen, who did this avod on the base of Migdash, which we put the stress on in our davening, The Meshech Chachma downplays it. He says it's mitzvah pratik, a chol mitzvah. It's just a private mitzvah. It actually has much more meaning to us because we relive it by reciting it in the davening. But in the days of the Beis Hamikdash, this was something that could be totally out of mind. It has nothing to do with you. Then he says, but this is different than, let's say, Pesach. And not just Pesach, the other holidays, they all would come to the Jerusalem. And this was, he explains it. So this is quite interesting that he says that, in a sense, Yom Kippur is just a private holiday. It's not a national holiday. It doesn't tie us together as a nation the way the other holidays do. And therefore, the prophets had no reason to speak about it. Just one more example of the originality of Rav Meir Simcha, and I especially, his Hebrew, the way he speaks about Hergesh Le'umi. If you were to tell someone that the Meshech Chachma, writing in the early 20th century, would use Hebrew words like that, speak the word le'umi, people would not believe you. But it's here, black and white. If you want to check it, it's Parshas Achrimos, chapter 16, Pasuk Lamed Aleph 34. And finally, one more point before we start. One of you, I can't remember which one, so maybe one of you will remind me. You recall that when we did the classes on Rabbi Yisrael Moshe Chazan, the rabbi of Rome, I spoke about that custom, and I speak about it every summer when I take my group to Rome. Incidentally, those who are interested, the information about the summer trip to Italy will be up hopefully this week. I mean, it's already up, but not the prices, as well as the other trips. One of the things we spoke about was that you had a bit of firmkeit in Rome as well, something you wouldn't expect. You had people who started asking that after they die, they should be given malchus, lashes, which is something that used to be very rare among very pious people. I think Rishon Moshe Chazan says maybe once in a generation you had a super pious person that he would want after he died to be given these Malkos, or done all these sorts of things, not just Malkos, but the different types of punishments as a form of repentance. And I said that, you know, we haven't seen much of this recently, but he sent me from Rabbi Vosner in his volume of Responsa, volume 6, number 185, and it doesn't have a date here, but it's about 30 years ago. Lo and behold, he responds to a rabbi who had been asked by certain yeshiva students, that they wanted to start doing malkos and the four types of punishments. That is, there's four types of death penalties. They would do them not just symbolically, but so, for example, for, they would, well, sort of symbolically. Obviously, the person is dead, but they would do them, like, for example, for Srefa, for the burning. They would put hot wax on the dead person. And there were people in B'nai Brak about 30 years ago who wanted to start doing it again. And Rabbi Vosner is astonished. He says, no one does this. But then he goes through the response, and then he thinks that, people want to do it. That's their prerogative. I'm sorry. He says for special people, yes, but for the average people, he says no. We shouldn't do anything new like this. Okay, let's pick up now. Someone's playing around with my picture. I don't know, but it's fine. Just maybe it's tech support, but we'll leave it here. Okay, back to Rabbi Yechezkel Abramsky. I think the last thing I mentioned before we ended last week was that the Mashgiach of the yeshiva, Yehuda Leib Chasman, I forgot his first name now, slipping my mind. Rabbi Chasman, someone's going to write it in. I'm forgetting now his first name. He had begun inviting people to his house Friday night as a way of influencing them. Yeah, Leib Chasman. So, but I think it might be Yehuda Leib. Had to influence them in his Musar direction, and Rabbi Eliezer Gordon put a stop to this, seeing that it was creating, a sect in the yeshiva. And I mentioned, and this was the last thing I mentioned, that in 1897, the beginning of 1897, the students went on strike. They stopped learning. And according to one report, it was not really his inviting over students to his house, but there was a move, a campaign against the students who were reading Haskalah literature. And they simply stopped learning. They put away their books and said they would not start learning until their demands were met. I don't know of any other examples. There's been violence in yeshivas and all sorts of things. This is the first example I know of an actual strike. Now, I want to read to you what appears in Shaul Stamfer's book, because he deals with this a bit. Before I get to it, Yisrael asked me last week, I mentioned the classes. It's one of the novelties of the Tells Yeshiva. In Stamfer's book on page 293, he describes how the yeshiva was divided into three separate classes. It was a very modern place. In fact, in Tells, there was a gymnasium there. There was all sorts of modern things. It's interesting because you think today Tells is a very, right-wing place. But I wrote in one of my blog posts earlier this year, about how they had a machina program, and they used modern Hebrew, and it was quite a liberal place, much more liberal than other yeshivas. How it changed, and in America, that's a different story. There was a Rosh Yeshiva at YU who was a Telzer, and he's another one I can't remember the name of. He wrote a number of Svarim on Taros, and his name is escaping me, too. Those who are fans of Rabbi Rakefet, it was his first teacher at YU. I wrote about him also on one of the blog posts because he didn't like Rabbi Belkin, Dr. Belkin. He attacks Dr. Belkin a great deal. But if someone can remember the name, you know who I'm talking about. It's one. He would have been, had there not been a Holocaust, he would have been a great figure in Tells. So he said, he would mock the Tells of Cleveland, and he would say, this is not real Tells. Yes, Yisrael, the one who didn't like when the Bacharim kissed the mezuzah, and he also once, the mashkiach of the yeshiva, the Yeshiva Shabbat Zachon, and YU, was a Litvak, And, you know, my memory's going now because I can't remember his name either. He was the yeshiva there for 50 years, 40 years. Someone will write in or a lesson. Yeah, Yaakov Moshe Cohen lesson. He once got up at the end of Yom Kippur, and even though Yom Kippur was over, and he wanted to give one final Musar lesson, and what does this rabbi do? Someone's got to give me, someone's got to send the name in for me. It's killing me that I can't remember it. Rabbi Volk, yes, thank you, Bill. Rav Shmuel Volk, who was a genius, no question, but he had a strange personality. While Rabbi Lessen starts his drasha, Rabbi Volk gets up and tells him to sit down. You know, everyone's hungry, and he said, enough with this already. Rabbi Volk, there was issues there. He always was jealous of Rabbi Soloveitchik also. I mean, he said, I went to gymnasium, and, you know, they're not, people didn't, as Rakefet pointed out once, there's a difference between gymnasium and Tells and PhD from the University of Berlin. Be that as it may, Rabbi Volk, who was a Telzer, had harsh words, as was his way, for the Tells in America. But let me read you the what appears in Stamper, the description of the strike. Well, after the students went on strike, and we're dealing with teenagers, so many of them, Rav Lazar Gordon, he's described as being overcome with grief, and he gets up in the Beis Medrash and he says as follows. What I'm reading to you from comes from the memoirs of Rabbi Var Hoftig. I spoke about him last class. He says as follows. And this is Rabbi Var Hoftig, you know, 30 years or so, more than 30 years, 50 years even, after the fact, writing it down. So it's not going to be word for word, but this is the, I guess, the essence of it. So he says, this is what he says to the yeshiva. Seditious elements have led you astray. Their intention was not pure, and the administration has decided to expel them from the yeshiva for their own welfare and the welfare of all the yeshiva students. When you hear, by the way, who the leader of these rebellious yeshiva students, the ones who went on strike, I think some of you are going to fall over on your chair. So stay tuned. So he expels them. And then he gives the names of the 12 yeshiva students who rebelled. It is with great sorrow that I must announce that we have also decided to remove from his post at the yeshiva the righteous gaon, the Mashgiach Ruchani, that's the spiritual director, Rav Aryeh, it's Aryeh Leibchassman, since a great disaster has taken place because of him, and he will have to leave and live in another town. In other words, a compromise was done because they got rid of the 12 rebels, but they were just the troublemakers. The whole yeshiva went along with them. So as a compromise, they got rid of the rebels, threw them out, but he also fired Rav Aryeh Leibchassman. And what does he mean by a great disaster is taking place because of him? He blamed Rabbi Aryeh Leibchassman for the trouble. Aryeh Leibchassman comes in and tries to push Musar on, and the students didn't take to it. So who's to blame? It must be the Mashgiach's to blame. He's the one that's responsible for the strike and for all the problems. So the plan was to bring a different Mashgiach in, one who got along better with the students. And he goes further, Rav Lazar. He, that is Rabbi Leibchassman, made a mistake in his authoritarian ways and did not raise the spirit of Musar gradually, but all at once. And thus tempers rose and the recent events took place. And in addition, I announced that from now on, the students of classes 1 and 2 are exempt from Musar study, and thus I conclude my words. If you remember last class, part of the problem was that Rabbi Leibchassman also wanted the higher students, the best students, to also study Musar. So really, I think in the end, Lazar Gordon gives in a lot more than he gets. He gets rid of the 12 troublemakers, but he fires the Mashgiach. He gets rid of Musar for the two top classes. Really, the students win in this battle. After this happens, again, I don't know of any other examples of this where the Rosh Yeshiva really give in. The Rosh Yeshiva gives in to student demands like this. After this speech, a student representative went to Rav Lazar Gordon and asked for mercy, that he should lighten the weight of the decree. And he agreed to. The fact that, by the way, he's agreeing to all these things, again, just shows me that the weakness that he felt himself in. In those days, there's other great yeshivas. If the students are not happy, they can leave. They can go to Slabodka. They can go to Mir. There's other places. They don't need to be in Telz. So in the end, only six were expelled. And soon after that, Rabbi Bloch, who was the underling to Rav Lazer Gordon, Mishpacha, and also Rav Shimon Shkop, left as well. Now, as I mentioned last class, a complete description of the events that happened in Telz in 1897 is found in the introduction to one of Yeruchim Varhaftig's book. He was the father of Zorach Varhaftig, a leading Mizrahi figure, who Rav Yeruchim was, he wasn't a Mizrahi figure, he was more a Gudist type. He's from Poland, he was a Rav in Warsaw, and then he comes to Eretz Yisrael. His son is a leader in Mizrahi. And the grandson, there's a big Varhaftig family, a Rosh Yeshiva, and there's an academic scholar, also Talmud Chacham, named Varhaftig. And I mentioned also last class that even though the book was only printed once, there are changes in different editions, different copies of the book, and some of the details of the revolt in Telz don't appear in certain of the volumes. But I said that we're fortunate that in the book I showed you last class, Yeshivot Lita, which is a memoirs of Jewish life in the yeshivas in Lithuania, they were fortunate that the volume they used had all the material. So who was to take the place then of Rabbi Bloch and Rav Shimon Shkop? Bloch, incidentally, the Telz in America, son, and then a grandson of this Bloch, Yosef Leib Bloch. And so I wrote, that's, if you're interested, just to plug in Mark Spiro's Svarim blog, Bloch, you'll get all sorts of information about the Telz Yeshiva and what it was like, what it used to be like. To take the place of him, they hired a man by the name of Chaim Rabinowitz. Anyone who's been with us last semester knows that we spoke about Chaim Rabinowitz, because Beryl Wine somehow got it in his head that Chaim of Volozhin's name was Chaim Rabinowitz. And no, Chaim Rabinowitz is many years later, eight decades later, he becomes the Rosh Yeshiva, together with Leib Lazer Gordon. He's known as Reb Chaim Telzer. In fact, getting back to Rabbi Volk, this is also famous. Rabbi Volk would quote Reb Chaim, and people would say Reb Chaim Brisker, and he'd scream at them, no, Reb Chaim Telzer, because if you're in Telz, Reb Chaim Brisker is not so important, it's Reb Chaim Telzer. He had been teaching at Knesset Beis Yitzchak in Slobodka. Slobodka had two yeshivas. They had a Musar yeshiva, which is called, because Slobodka yeshiva split over the Musar movement. We have it when we do, we're going to have classes on Reb Baruch Ber Leibowitz. We'll have classes on Reb Yisrael Salanter. We'll have classes on the Altar of Slobodka. And Mirza Hashem, we'll have classes on all these figures. But then we'll talk about how the Musar dispute was so bad. I mean, I spoke about how bad it was just now in Telz, but in a certain way, it was just as bad in Slobodka. The students didn't go on strike, but they did other crazy things. They took the Musar books, if you can believe it, and they threw them in the latrine. And the yeshiva, had the yeshiva not split, maybe they would have gone on strike, but there was actually a split in the yeshiva. And for the sake of accuracy, though, you have to note that when they had the funeral, they actually had a funeral for the Musar books, the people from the non-Musar yeshiva came. Because these are holy books. The whole idea of the anti-Musar people wasn't that you should get rid of these books or anything. It was just that there's a time and place for them and you don't need to institute it. But you can't throw out Musar books, but you always have hotheads. So you had Knesset Yisrael, which is named after Yisrael Salanter. That's the Musar yeshiva. And then you have Knesset Beis Yitzchak, which is named after Rabbi Yitzchak Yochanan Spector. That's the non-Musar yeshiva. Rabbi Yitzchak Yochanan Spector's son was a big anti-Musar person, Ratzius Rabinowitz, and they named after him. Chaim Rabinowitz had been teaching at the non-Musar yeshiva, and which this yeshiva, by the way, still exists to this day in Eretz Yisrael. I don't know how much of a connection there is to it, but some of you might be interested that the Rosh Yeshiva today is a man by the name of Yitzchak Shiner. He actually is a bit of a student of Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg because he was in Switzerland at the yeshiva there in Montreux. If you read his biography a few weeks ago, Yateid Naaman or Hamodia, one of them did a whole biography of him because there was some anniversary of this yeshiva. And they talked about him studying under the Brisker Rav and everything. They omit one interesting important point. He went to yeshiva college, Yeshiva Rabbi Yitzchak Yochanan. He was there 2 years, if I'm not mistaken. I don't think it was any more. He was from Pittsburgh. And he left there, and then he went to Israel. But, of course, that has to be omitted. If you want to get the details, William Helmreich's book of a number of years ago on the world of the yeshiva, he has an interview and gives his biography. So Chaim Rabinowitz comes to Telz, and he was great. You know, no problems, great Talmud Chacham, the students loved him, a very high level of learning. The problem is he wasn't a family member. And as we know, the yeshivas are family institutions. And I don't blame it for being that way. If I put in all the effort to build the yeshiva, raise all the money, why would I give it away to someone who's not for me? The only example we have of this is Rav Amital of Har Etzion. He builds the yeshiva and he writes in Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, and he was even going to give him the whole yeshiva. He said, you could be the Rosh Yeshiva. I'll just be a minor functionary. And Rav Aaron insisted on that both of them remain co-Rosh Yeshivas. And Rav Aaron Lichtenstein many times said that this is the only, never seen such an example like this, where someone builds an institution and is willing, for the sake of what he thinks to be the betterment of the institution, completely give it up. You know, give it to Rav Aaron Lichtenstein to run because he thinks he's a greater Talmud Chacham, and let him run the show. But Rav Blazer Gordon felt he had to bring a family member in, and he tries to appoint one of his sons-in-laws, but the students again rebel. They said they don't want this son-in-law. They don't think he's a big enough Talmud Chacham. Now let me read you part of the memoir, not of Varhaftig, but of a man named Simcha Asaf. Simcha Asaf was on the first Israeli Supreme Court. He was the religious judge. He is someone who's well known. He's one of the great scholars of Mishpat Ivri. In fact, he's one of the people who built the field of Mishpat Ivri. When you think Mishpat Ivri, you think of Menachem Ilon, but Simcha Asaf was before him. He was a great, great scholar, great Talmud Chacham. He was a Rosh Yeshiva in Lida at Rav Reines's more modern yeshiva. It was after Rav Reines had already passed away. And he's appointed to the Israeli Supreme Court. But he is also a great Talmud Chacham, and he's a Telzer. And he wrote a memoir of his time in Telz. A very interesting memoir, also found in that book I mentioned. So let me read to you two paragraphs of how Simcha Asaf describes this, the second rebellion. Now, this rebellion was 8 years later. It was 1905. Rav Chaim Telzer was there, and Blazer Gordon figured that he dies just 5 years later. You have to put someone in who's family. So this is how Simcha Asaf describes it. Shortly before Hanukkah 1905, an open rebellion broke out among the students, which they called a hupka. The hupka used to begin with a shah. The hundreds of students would be studying aloud, much louder than usual, and suddenly silence would fall. A whisper ran through the throng, shah, and silence reigned, so absolute that one could hear the buzzing of a fly. Picture the scene here, hundreds of students in the base medrash. The noise level was very high, and all of a sudden, absolute quiet. After a few seconds, the students would start to study again very loudly, and then came another shah, and then a third and a fourth. This shah boded no good. It was a sign of the coming storm. At the end of the time set for study, the students would throw down the benches and shtenders and leave the yeshiva hall in complete disarray. They finished learning and they just threw everything around. A hupka occurred for the third year running near the start of the study term when the rabbi tried to appoint his second son-in-law, Rav Yitzchak Isaac Hershowitz, as a second teacher at the yeshiva. He had studied for several years at the Telz yeshiva, and after marrying a Blazer's daughter, had been supported by him for 11 or 12 years studying Torah. He was very diligent and had great knowledge of the Talmud and its commentaries, but he was not distinguished in sharp and original debate and had not acquired the affection of the students. He was a fierce opponent of Zionism, and this too brought him many opponents, and since many of the students were Zionists. So it appears that this happens in 1905, but even the two previous years, the students were still in the rebellious moods of doing this hupka thing. So what does Rav Blazer Gordon do? Despite this, he appoints his son-in-law. And the students, it's described by Asaf, would harass him during his shiurim. Many failed to attend the classes, and others would just harass him. They'd ask him questions and, bother him. And then just before Hanukkah, as we saw, the real revolt broke out. And it was quite violent. This is how maybe violent is too strong a word, but this is what Asaf writes. There was complete uproar. The lights were shattered. They broke the lights. Benches were overturned. Many windows were broken, and the students ran off home. This went on for a few days. Regular studies resumed after a couple of days, but Rabbi Gordon grieved and disappointed, especially by his own student from the fifth class, that is the highest class. His own students turned against him, ceased to teach them. The students felt they had been rebuked and stopped visiting the rabbi's home. The affectionate ties between the rabbis and the students were broken. Reb Lazer Gordon could not endure the situation for long, however. He had no life except in the yeshiva with his students, and after 2 months, he began to teach again. For 2 months, he stopped teaching his students, saying that they weren't worthy of it. But the students were again victorious. Rabbi Hershowitz was forced to stop teaching. We have other examples of this. When the Netziv tried to appoint his son, Rav Chaim Berlin, as a Rosh Hashiva, the students didn't think he was great enough, and they too revolted. But I know of no example of this in modern times. The closest example I think we can see is when the students tried to revolt when they wanted to appoint a president of YU who wasn't a Rosh Yeshiva. At first, the first name was Dov Zakheim, and they went crazy. And truthfully, it was the best thing that happened to Richard Joel, because it's like, you know, you have a hot bathtub, the first ones to go and cool it down. When then they announced Richard Joel's appointment, they tried to get the students going again, some of the Rosh Yeshiva, but they had all been protested out because they, you know, had Joel been appointed, announced first, then they would have protested him. He probably would have had to withdraw. And then if Zakheim was announced, they would have had, you know, they wouldn't have had any more motivation. And it turns out it wasn't such a bad thing for them, because Richard Joel doesn't mess around, mix in with the Rosh Yeshiva. He lets them do their own thing. They wanted a Rosh Yeshiva so much. You know, with Dr. Lamb, they had issues because he would interfere. If they appointed a Rosh Yeshiva, someone who could learn, then he can put forth his own ideas. Richard Joel, everyone knows what he is. He's a public spokesman. He raises money. And not to mention the fact that as soon as he was appointed, one of his very first things, if not the first thing he did, was call in all the Rosh Yeshiva and give them raises. So, you know, let them know that they don't have to worry about him. So when they got rid of the teaching of Rabbi Hershowitz, peace was resumed in Telz, but not for long, because there still was a problem. What was the problem? There still were the mashgichim. Telz is a Musar yeshiva, so to ask them to totally get rid of Musar, that's basically, you know, uprooting the entire ethos of the yeshiva. Reb Lazer Gordon compromised that the highest classes didn't need to study it, but there still had to be Mashgiach. And Reb Lazer Gordon thought for the younger classes and the ones who aren't so advanced, he believed in Musar. He was a Musar person. It's not that he opposed it. If he opposed it, he just would have gotten rid of them. He believed in it. And he thought that it just takes time to get the students attracted to it. What did these Mashgichim do? I mean, it's not like it was overbearing in the yeshiva. The students who had to attend, the lower classes who had to attend, had to study Musar, all you had to do was half hour a day, half hour a night, from 9:30 to 10 p.m. And you know something? If I was there in Telz, I think I would have been like Rabbi Yechezkel Abramsky, who we described last week, you know, had no involvement in this whole dispute. It's so terrible to sit for half hour, read a book, a Musar book, and if you don't want to read it, so you can daydream, you can do something else. When I was in yeshiva, we had Musar Seder also. Half the guys had a Gemara in front of them. Most people didn't pay attention to it. But that was it. But the students didn't like it, even this half hour. In fact, it's described, I think it's Varhofer, Asaf, I think this is the one who describes it. They set up a booby trap, some troublemakers. It doesn't say what was in the booby trap. I'm hoping it was water. We have another example from, I think it was from Volozhin, where they set up unclean water, but it doesn't say what. It just says a jar. This is Friday night, and when one of the mashgichim walked by, they were standing on top, they turned it over, and it went all on him. Can you imagine the lack of respect for the mashgiach to throw things on? But when you think of it, if I think of the high school, my local modern Orthodox high school, you can imagine some troublemakers doing something like that, you know, put a tack on a teacher's chair, and that's what we're dealing with in these yeshivas. These are immature people. Many of them, if there were universities, if Jews could enter university, they wouldn't, or if they had modern Orthodox schools, they wouldn't be going to the yeshivas. These yeshivas had all types. The booby trap jug falls on him. Let me read you one more time from Asaf's memoir. Of the 12 students, you know, Rabbi Laser Gordon. So the Shiva students, again, 12 students were in Rabbi Hershowitz this year. Of those 12 students, 8 were sent away. In other words, this, again, you have to deal with the troublemakers. And several of the younger students, that is, who weren't in Rabbi Hershowitz's year, they were sent away as well. Many of those who traveled home for the festival, thinking they would return immediately afterwards, became lovayonics. That is, they were not loyavonics, like the word loyavo. They were not permitted to return. So you had 8 Talmidim who just were sent away from the rabbi's shir, and also some younger ones who were sent away. And then you had other students who weren't sent away, but when they went home, they then received letters saying, don't come back. As I said, and they were known as lo yavonics, don't come. According to yeshiva regulations, every student who went home had to receive written permission to return to the yeshiva. Those with whom the yeshiva administration was not pleased received a negative answer, lo yavo. So what did they do? You need to have the yeshiva here. You can't. He doesn't tell us how many were percentage-wise were thrown out. He tells us 30 or 40 students were thrown out. If I'm not mistaken, there was about 300 students at the time. So you're talking about 10%, even more, of the student body in the Tel's yeshiva being thrown out. To replace the students who have been sent away, and the lo yavonics, he doesn't say that. No, it's the 30 or 40 students who were brought in. He doesn't say how many were thrown out. In any event, though, maybe it was the same number. What did he do? 30 or 40 students were brought in from the Sabbatka yeshiva by agreement with the administration there, which was interested in bringing the renowned Tel's yeshiva into the fold of the Musar movement. To replace the ones thrown out, they brought in Sabbatka students. The Sabbatka students and the altar of Sabbatka was very happy to send his students to different places to spread Musar. And this was a way to bring Musar to Tel's and to defeat the opponents of Musar in Tel's. Because think of it, Tel's is supposed to be teaching Musar, and you have opposition inside the yeshiva. These students have no business doing that. If they don't want to learn Musar, they should go to Knesset Beis Yitzchak. They go somewhere else. Among the arrivals were all the lions of the company. That means the great Talmidim. Some of whom eventually served at Mashgichim. Many of them became elders of the generation. Students aged 30 and older. And we tell students never became accustomed to this type. You had students in Sabbatka who were 30 years old and over. We have that today. We know about yeshivas that old, but Sabbatka was pretty unique in that respect. Now, the veteran students, of course, were very opposed to bringing in these Sabbatka students. And they called another strike. And the yeshiva, this all took place in 1905, 1906. The yeshiva had to close again. And what did these students do? The students collected money, had their own shiurim. They paid people to prepare shiurim. And this went on for a few months. Then what happened? Once again, the students are victorious. The new mashgiach had been appointed, and the students from Sabbatka were forced to leave. Rabbi Laser Gordon realized that he's not the lunatic. You know, what's the expression? The lunatics are running the asylum. The students are running the yeshiva. This is now the third or fourth time he has to give in to the students. And they emerge victorious. And who is the leader of the student rebels in 1905? None other than Rabbi Yosef Kahanovich, who later becomes famous as the founder of the Ponevez Yeshiva. Someone who was very, had a lot of ingenuity and a lot of energy. He founded institutions. I mean, the Ponevez Yeshiva was an amazing institution. He was the leaders of the rebels. His nephew, incidentally, spells the name differently, but his nephew is Daniel Kahneman, Princeton psychologist, psychoeconomist, whatever you call it, Nobel Prize winner in economics in 2002. I assume that he is not religious at all. He's his nephew, not a great nephew, a nephew. The reason I don't think so is because Yosef Kahneman had medical issues in the 1960s, and he came to America, and he was in a hospital in Washington Heights by the cloisters. There's a hospital, I don't know the name of it, around there. Rabbi Soloveitch used to go visit him. So someone asked me a question about this last year, and I suggested that he contact... I didn't even know, by the way, at the time that Daniel Kahneman, he told me they spelled the name differently. So I got him the email address, and I suggested, maybe it's one of you listening to me right now, I can't remember who, and he emailed And I can't remember whether he emailed or I emailed because we were CCing each other on the emails, Kahneman. The question was he did, because the question was he wanted to find out about Rabbi Yosef Kahneman. Did he do anything when he was in America? Because he was here for I think it was even months he was in America. And the fact that Daniel Kahneman didn't even know that his uncle, his father's brother, was in America for all that time, I think it's fair to say he's somewhat estranged, or they're estranged from him, or he's estranged from them, that there's no contact between Daniel Kahneman and the Kahnemans in Eretz Yisrael. The fact that he didn't even know that his uncle was here for that long for medical treatment. It was an extended time, actually. It was definitely for months. Now, Stamfer claims, by the way, I see someone's, okay, anyone who emails me, if you want to send it, if you want me to see, you should send it to everyone, unless it's private. But I saw Bill Gewirtz emailed, and it was blinking. So I looked. Bill points out Columbia Presbyterian. That was the hospital that Rivka Hahnemann was in. Stamfer claims that in order to understand this revolt, he's talking particularly the student rebellion of 1905. That was the big one. It went on for many months, enough to close the yeshiva. It's not enough just to look at the Musar dispute, he says. You have to look at the revolutionary mood in Russia at this time. And that was also a factor. You know, we know about the 1905 revolution. We know about the rise of communist thinking and everything. Many Jews were attracted to it. There were real feelings of rebellion in the air, not just political rebellion, which took place in Russia. They forced the Tsar to do all sorts of things to compromise. But the yeshivas were very much affected by it. He also points out something interesting, because we know a lot of these figures who were involved in this, that most of the anti-Musar students who left the yeshiva, that is, were thrown out of the yeshiva, they didn't go to other yeshivas. They ended up joining political organizations. They decided to study for the gymnasium exams. That itself shows you that they were there sort of because that was the place to be, not that they were really committed to Torah study. And we know that in the 19th and early 20th century, when it was much more difficult for Jews to go to the university, Jews went to the yeshivas for all sorts of reasons. Bialik mentions that he went to Volozhin because he heard it was a center of Haskalah. And there was Haskalah, but he was disappointed. It wasn't as much as he thought. There's all sorts of reasons people went to yeshivas. You're an intellectual. To escape from home. To find a good wife. We know that the rich fathers would come and they would want to find the best bacher for their daughter. So if you want to find a shidduch. So the yeshivas were filled of all sorts of people who were not there necessarily for learning. If you read Stamfer's book, you get all the details. I've only given you the summary of it. He points out that real peace, because there, you know, you really didn't get real peace in the yeshiva, even though it was a lower level of feuding and disputes, real peace only returned to the yeshiva in 1910. And then other interesting things happened in the yeshiva. He doesn't take it out entirely. He doesn't take it up to the World War II or anything. He sort of ends, around 1910. He speaks about the significance of the Telz yeshiva. The book, Three Lithuanian Yeshivas, is Volozhin, Slobodka, and Telz. And in the new edition here, the English volume, he has an appendix on the Kolel Prushim, the little Kolel they had in Kovno, which we've spoken about. Okay, so now let's return the whole class and part of last class, all was because I mentioned that when Rechiskel Abramsky came to Telz, and these incredible events were taking place, really unheard of in the modern yeshiva movement, that by the hagiography of Rechiskel Abramsky, all it says is that even though Rechiskel Abramsky was there during this time, it simply says during the dispute over Musar, he kept out of it. So we get no information whatsoever from the hagiography. So let's return now to Rabbi Yechezkel Abramsky. He leaves Telz right after the great dispute. He leaves in 1906, and he goes to Vilna. In Vilna, you had, in addition to yeshivas, you had these things, we've spoken already about them, called in the singular a kibbutz, but we'd say today a kibbutz. What is a kibbutz? It's a place where people gather. And they would, you can gather like a settlement in Israel and a farm, or you can gather in a yeshiva. It means a small group of people who gather. It's not really a yeshiva, but it's a small group, a chabura, we could call it, whatever you want to call it. And Rav Chaim Ozer had one where very learned people, we're not dealing with youngsters, and we're not dealing with people, any guy who's just in yeshiva, we're dealing with very advanced students, would come to Vilna, and you couldn't just get in, you had to be approved to come into it. And Rav Chaim Ozer, they would basically learn on their own, but he would talk with them in learning. He would, give a shiur now and then. It wasn't regular shiurim, but he would be their guide and the person who guided them in their Torah advancement. In addition, so Chatzko Abramsky went into this kibbutz, and he also studied in the Ramelis yeshiva. Yeshiva that today most people never heard of, but there was a yeshiva in Vilna called the Ramelis Yeshiva, which was run by Reb Chaim Ozer Rosinsky's older brother. Why did he go to Vilna, though? He actually didn't go to study Torah. While there, he studied Torah, but the reason he went is because he had been told, the big problem for people his age in Russia was to get out of the draft. Jews usually were able to get out of the draft, because if you bribed someone, you could bribe the doctor, or you could pay to have someone take your place, pay a poor family, and then a person would take your place. Now, what do you mean take your place? He should be in the draft also, but there was all sorts of ways people were out of the draft, and if you had already been given exemption, let's say, for a medical reason or something, you could then put yourself back in it. There was if I'm not mistaken, at this time, if you were an only child, you didn't have to go to the draft also, if I'm not mistaken. That would be an example of someone you could pay. There's all sorts of ways you can get people to take your place. If you couldn't get people to take your place, or if you couldn't get your way out of the draft, the only answer then was to leave. I have a letter from Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg I've never published. One of the early letters he wrote from 1905, I think it is, 1904, in which he says he got out of it, I believe, on a medical exemption, but he says he's going to, he has to appear before the board, and if he doesn't get the exemption, there's only one answer, and that's to leave the country. And that wasn't hard. That wasn't hard at all. You go to England, you come to America, but that was the last resort. So what is it? Chesko Bromsky was told that there's people who could help him in Vilna. Now, it's not just showing up. He comes already with a very good reputation, with letters to Rav Chaim Ozer Rosinsky. So when he comes to Vilna, Rav Chaim Ozer would be able to introduce him to people, rich people who can make it happen. And that's exactly what happened. While in Vilna, a rich Jew was found who bought his way out of the draft. There were times, depending on the years, where you didn't even have to find someone to take your place. You could just pay a certain amount to the local draft board, which I assume was just pocketed by them, and that would exempt you. While in Vilna, Rabbi Chesko Abramsky got married, and the shidduch was made by Rav Chanoch Egis, the author of the great work, The Marcheshes. We've spoken also about him a good deal. I just mention this because those who've been with us, and I recognize most of your names, you remember all these things, but I also see new names. And I know, because I've received emails already, that there are people listening this semester who've never listened in previous semesters. And those who haven't, for $10, you can download all the classes in 1 month. You have unlimited. So, but when we dealt with Rav Chaim Ozer Grzinski, which was our longest series, 8 classes, of Rav Chaim Ozer. We dealt with Rav Chanoch Henoch Aigis, who was a very great Talmudist, a Mizrahi leader, incidentally. And sat on the same base tin as Rav Chaim Ozer. Who did he marry? He married the daughter of a man named Yisroel Yerushalayimsky. Not a well-known person, not significant, not heard of. The only reason he's significant is because he was the son-in-law of the Ridbaz, Yaakov David Wolofsky, who we also had classes about. Great, great figure. After the marriage, Rabbi Chesko Abramsky, as was the custom, was supported by his father-in-law. And as we say in rabbinic parlance, he sat and learned. During this period, which they call the period of Kest, when you're supported by your father-in-law, he also went to Brisk. And that was his first relationship, his connection to Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, that he will see he has a very close relationship to him, but that's the first thing. The next significant event of his life comes in 1912, when he's asked by Rav Sholom Dovber Schneerson, the Rashab, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, to teach in the Lubavitch Yeshiva yeshiva. Tomchei Tamimim Lubavitch had established a yeshiva 15 years before in the city of Lubavitch. Hasidim came late to establish yeshivas. In Poland, they didn't have Hasidic yeshivas. I mean, there's a, in Hungary, there's a reason why they preferred learning in the Batei Midrash. You know, yeshivas have all sorts of problems, as we've seen. You bring these young people together, they're bound to create problems. But Lubavitch established a yeshiva in the city of Lubavitch, and then they put branches of this yeshiva throughout Russia. The name of the yeshiva was picked by the Rashab, Tomchei Tamimim, and refers to the fact that in this yeshiva, the idea was to study the entire Torah, not just Poskim, Halacha, Talmud, what we call Nigla, but also Nistar. But really not Nistar, I would say Chassidut. And really, in a Chabad yeshiva, they're very limited in what sort of Chassidut they study. But the idea was that it wasn't just open Torah, traditional Talmudic learning. It was also Chassidut, mystical things, etc. And the Bachrim, the students, were called Tamim. I don't know if they, I mean, they still have yeshivas, Tomchei Tamim and everything. That's the name of the various Lubav yeshivas are still called that, but I don't know if the Bachrim themselves anymore refer to themselves as Tamim. But in Europe, but in Russia, they called themselves Tamim. They even had a newspaper called Tamim. Tamim means like the complete ones, the pure ones, something along those lines. Rav Yecheskel Abramsky did not last very long at this yeshiva. He was let go. We don't know why. All the hagiography on him says is that the Seder, the order of the yeshiva was disturbed by him, because sometimes students would stay after shiur to discuss Talmudic points with them, and they would be, you know, that would disturb the next shiur. After his shiur was the shiur in Tanya. And they would be staying late talking and learning with him, and instead of coming to the Tanya shiur or coming late. And that was viewed as, I assume they spoke to him about this, maybe he didn't care, whatever it was, they thought he wasn't a team player, and they let him go. Rav Shach had the same issues, incidentally. His first job was teaching at a Carlin Stolen yeshiva. And he too, the story I told when we did classes on him, it's mentioned in one of the biographies, was that once the Rebbe came to town and the whole yeshiva emptied out to go see the Rebbe, and Rav Shach was furious about this. So the same thing, Rav Yecheskel Abramsky, he obviously thought that learning Gemara, what he had to do, was at least as important as Tanya. And so he was let go. This was what appears in the hagiography, and I think this makes perfect sense, would be the real reason. If you don't get along with the Chabad ideology, if you're not at least willing to tolerate it, the Rebbe, the Rashab, always, not just the Rashab, even Rav Nachum Mendel, they like to have non-Lubavitchers. They thought that was a nice thing to have non-Lubavitchers teaching in yeshiva, which you have to be sympathetic and you have to go along with it. And he didn't show proper deference. Yet, it couldn't have been a personal thing, because even after this, even after he was let go from the yeshiva, the relationships between the Rebbe Rashab and Rav Yecheskel Abramsky were still good. How do I know this? Because not long after that, or maybe this was, maybe it was part of the deal. You know, maybe take back what I said. Maybe it wasn't that relations were so good, but when they fired him, part of the deal was that if a Rabbonus opened up, the Rebbe would intervene. Because shortly after that, a rabbinate opened in the town of Shmolian, which was a Lubavitch town, and the Rebbe recommended him for the position. And of course, if it's a Lubavitch town and the Rebbe recommends you, there's not much choice in that matter. It's an open and shut case. So the Rebbe told them that Rav Yecheskel Abramsky is going to be the Rav of this town. And there's also a tradition among Chabad towns of having non-Chabad rabbis. Not exclusively, they have Chabad rabbis too, but they have no opposition to having non-Chabad rabbis. The most famous of these is Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, who in Chaslovich, that was a Chabad town. But you have plenty of other examples of non-Chabad rabbis in Chabad towns, and the Chabadniks were always respectful of them as long as the rabbi understood that he had one job, and that was to be the Rav of the town, to Paskin the Shilas. He was not the spiritual leader. The spiritual leader, the one who they looked to for spiritual guidance, was the Rebbe. But in terms of being a technician, of deciding halacha questions, that was the Rav. And I think you have to give Chabad a lot of credit for that. It shows a great deal of open-mindedness that they were willing to entrust halacha decisions for their flock to non-Chabad rabbis. They could have filled all these positions with Chabad rabbis. However, if it's a choice between a second-rate Chabad rabbi and getting a first-rate Talmud Chacham, as long as the first-rate Talmud Chacham was willing to be respectful of Chabad and of the Rebbe and understand his place, that, you know, if the Rebbe comes to town, the Rebbe's the one in charge, then they had no difficulties choosing non-Chabad rabbis. I'll go for a couple more minutes, then I'll take questions. Rav Abramsky, Rabbi Chesko, was like Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg. Those who've read my book on Rabbi Weinberg know that Rabbi Weinberg was very involved in the intellectual currents of the day, the Jewish world in particular, and he was also a very good Hebrew stylist, Rabbi Weinberg. The same thing can be said about Rabbi Chesko Abramsky. There's a group of these Russian-Lithuanian rabbis, Rav Zevin's another one of them, who were very attuned to what was going on, wrote a beautiful Hebrew, read the Haskalah literature. Later on, I'll talk about, in a future class, Rabbi Chesko Abramsky's relationship with Bialik. Rabbi Chesko knew all of Bialik's poetry. It's quite interesting. And as with Rabbi Weinberg, Rabbi Chesko and Rav Zevin, Rabbi Chesko Abramsky wrote in the early Hebrew journal Yad Torah. He wrote in the newspaper Hamodia. He was one of the young rabbis. The older rabbis were not Hebrew stylists. They couldn't write this way. They were just interested in Torah. They didn't leave their four cubits, their Dalet Amos. It was the young rabbis, the intellectuals, people like Weinberg, Abramsky, Zevin, and other ones like them, Yehuda Leib Tzirilson, Eliyahu Akiva Rabinowitz of Poltava. You had a whole group of younger generation of rabbis who were the intellectual leaders, in a sense, because they were writing, they weren't the spiritual leaders, they were the intellectual leaders, because the Gedolim of the older generation, they're not writing articles in newspapers, they're not influencing the younger rabbis. In 1914, after 2 years in Shmolian, he becomes Rav in a place called Shmolevich, which was next to Minsk, and he took the place of another great, great figure who I would love to do classes on. The problem is there's no biography, and it would require an enormous amount of work without a biography to do the classes, and that is Rav Avram Dov Ber Kahana Shapiro. Again, I call your attention to that earlier post that I dealt with the Tel situation. Rav Avram Dov Ber Kahana Shapiro, as I've mentioned numerous times, is as close as you can get to be a modern Orthodox rabbi in Lithuania as there is one. Someone who supports a modern Orthodox type of high school for boys and girls, Hebrew, one who stands up against the yeshivas, one who supports evenings for boys and girls to come together to meet each other. I mean, basically, you're dealing with a modern Orthodox rabbi who happened to be one of the, maybe the greatest post-sec in all of Lithuania. In fact, I think that's an accurate statement. The most important post-sec in Lithuania in the 1930s. Not at this time, we're talking in 1914, but by the time we get to the 1930s, I think him and Ruchai Moser, actually, both of those two, in Kovno and Vilna. Ruchai Moser would be the most important, and Rav Avram Dov Ber Kahana Shapiro, the Dvar Avram, will be the second most important, just like Vilna is the most important city, and I say Lithuania, even if it's technically in Poland geographically, based upon the switching borders, it's still Jewish Lithuania, and Kovno would be the second most important city. So why don't we stop here, because we're now going to move on to Rabbi Chesko Abramsky. His time in this city is important because that's where you see his literary productions, other things. So let's stop here. It's already 1 or 2 minutes of, and if there's any questions, Yossi says that the Dvar Avram supported an Erev in a large city. Well, you know, Rav Chaim Ozer supported an Erev in a large city too, so I don't know. There was a movement called the Yavna. There was a school system, and really a movement called Yavna, that was centered in Kovno, the Dvar Avraham was the leader of this movement. And this was a modern Orthodox movement. It's not German modern Orthodoxy, but it's Lithuanian modern Orthodoxy. I even have a doc. Well, it's not a document. It's like a plaque. Someone took a picture of it for me, which talks. They opened, I think it's the Tarbut School, or one of these modern Hebrew schools, or Avram Dov Ber Kahana Shapiro was one of the speakers there. If he's the rabbi of Vilna, of Kovno, I'm not saying he loved, you know, these type of schools, but if he's the rabbi, he has to, you know, go to these events as well. If you haven't seen the post, look back at the post. You know, he raised children. He had a modern Orthodox type household. Rabbi Ram from Yeshiva University knew the Kovno Rav very well, and he described to Zalman Alpert, who's the librarian, you know, his household. And I'll tell you something else, which hasn't appeared in print. because Rabbi Nassim Kamenetsky wouldn't allow me to put it in print, but I'm telling you now, in Making of a Gadol, when I wrote my post on this, I for some reason I didn't look in Making of a Gadol, and someone in the comments there pointed out what in Making of a Gadol he quotes his father, Yaakov Kamenetsky, speaking about you know, how liberal and moderate the Kovno Rav was, and that he even went and got smicha from him. What he says something like him, he had some similarities to Haskalah, something like that. But Nassim Kamenetsky told me what his father really said. That is, what he wrote in the book is not what his father said. Nassim Kamenetsky apparently feels he could write things that aren't true, but whatever. He told me what his father really said was that, not that the, you have to look to see the exact lashon, the exact wording, not that the Kovno Rav had Haskalah characteristics, but that, quote, the Kovno Rav was a maskil. And Rabbi Rum described, you know, obviously a firm maskil, but this was a Torah Umada, Torah Imderach Eretz, modern Orthodox home in the context of Lithuania, where obviously Torah is central, but together with Torah, see, in Germany, Torah Imderach Eretz, there's more Derach Eretz than Torah. I mean, it's very rare in Germany you found someone who had any real serious Torah knowledge. But in Lithuania, Torah is still central, but it's, you know, if you're thinking of the, you know, a personality of Rabbi Soloveitchik, that's what the Kovno Rav was. Not someone who went to the university or anything like that, but someone who was open and who believed in it. His kids went to the university, and it's no accident that the Rav and went to the Kovno Rav to speak to them and get a recommendation. Okay, so we'll stop here. I'll take some of the questions. Yisrael asks, or says, yes, the Kovno, he didn't just say it, he wrote it. Did he write it, or is that the Rav Moshe Soloveitchik quoting him as saying it? I can't remember now if we have the letter. Manfred Lehman published a letter. No, he published a letter from the, he published a letter from Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. It's called Av Me'id Al Beno. I think it's in that letter that Moshe Soloveitchik says it. I don't remember if we actually have the Kovno Rav, but it's famous. The Kovno Rav was, the Kovno Rav suffered, by the way. The Kovno Rav suffered from the yeshivas. They did not think he was from enough. Even though he was a great postsake, they saw him as an adversary and not one who was on their side at all. They saw him the exact same way that the yeshivas in the 1960s and 70s saw Rabbi Soloveitchik, as a great Torah scholar, but one who is their opposition, one who is really preventing their approach from dominating. No, Rabbi Schwab did not write to him. Rabbi Schwab wrote, when he wrote that famous letter, he wrote to the Rubbitschtaber, he wrote to Rabbi Bloch, by the way, and he wrote to the Gerer Rebbe. The Gerer Rebbe refused to answer it. He wrote to the Rubbitschtaber. He only, I don't know how many he wrote. He might have written to the Kovno Rav. We don't know. Not everything perhaps has survived, the ones he wrote to. Okay, so Bill reminds us that it's what Rav Moshe Soloveitchik said, the letter said about Rabbi Soloveitchik, his son. Rabbi, the Kovno Rav comes to America in 1924 to join with Rav Kook and Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein in raising money for the yeshivas. I quoted in my post even a cynical comment, Lithuanian cynicism, where Revel had to leave one of their gatherings because he said he has to go recite, go do Kaddish. And the Kovno Rav says to him, what, you too? You too hold that? Someone wrote to me after I published that Rav Charlap actually says that, you know, if you're learning, you know, you can learn Mishnayos instead of doing Kaddish. And apparently there was a Lithuanian idea that, not like today where we're mockpit on all the Kaddishes, that if you're learning, you don't need to leave your learning to go find a minyan. You stay here, you daven b'yechidus. If you're learning, that covers instead of Kaddish. Yossi says, Baruch Ber. I don't know what Yossi's referring to, so he'll have to send it in. Yisrael says, a Mizrahi was on the Vilna Beis Din with Rav Chaim Ozer. Would that be against Rav Chaim Ozer's desire or not? Not at all. Rav Chaim Ozer appointed him to the Beis Din. If you don't recall, listen, go back to the tapes on Rav Chaim Ozer. Rav Chanach Egis was one of the great, great Torah scholars. He was Mizrahi, and he was on the Beis Din. There were no politics. There was also an Agudas Rabbanim in Poland. And in Lithuania, and in all the Agudas Rabbanims in America, even and in Europe, these were non-political. You had Mizrahi, and you had Agudistin on it. Today, it's hard to imagine that. But that's just because the Haredim, among the things they've done, one of the bad things they've done is that they've made a political litmus test. I mentioned it already, that this is one of the worst things that the Haredi world has done, is that they've determined that if you don't have the right political outlook, you're not valid in terms of P'sak or anything like that. In Europe, if you were a Mizrahi and the Rav was Aguda, he answered the Shailas. If you were Aguda and the Rav was Mizrahi, he answered the Shailas. And on political matters, you didn't hold from him, and that's not a big deal. And in all the Agudas Rabbanims, and these countries all had different rabbinic organizations, there was no distinctions between Mizrahi or Aguda. And Rav Chaim Ozer was Aguda, but he was very close to many Mizrahi people, and Rav Chanach Eiges was on his Beistin. And if you recall, Rav Chanach Eiges resigns from the Mizrahi after the Mizrahi puts up Rav Yitzhak Rubinstein to challenge Rav Chaim Ozer. They thought that maybe they thought that Eiges would go along with him because he's Mizrahi. But they didn't. Bill says, both Rabbi Soloveitchik and the Kovno Rav have very stringent views on Geirut, much stricter than Rav Chaim Ozer. Yes, as we spoke about in the classes on Rav Chaim Ozer, the Kovno Rav disagrees with Rav Chaim Ozer. Rav Chaim Ozer's attitude, basically, as long as it's not one of the big things, like you're going to say, I'm not going to observe Shabbos at all, but if you're just going to commit sins because you have an inclination, even if you violate occasionally Shabbos, things like that, you can be converted for that. It's only if you make it as a matter of principle that you're not going to observe these. And the Kovno Rav writes to him rejecting that. That is correct. And Rav Soloveitchik also had stringent views on conversion as well. Again, Yossi, I'm not sure what you mean that Rav Shimon wrote to him. I don't know whose him is. Yisrael says it's hard to imagine Bahrain being so spunky as they were in Tells. Today they seem so obedient and docile. Was Tells a wild exception? Or is there something about modern times that takes the spunk out of people? I think there's a couple things. First of all, we have to remember that you had many people went to yeshivas that went there because they, you know, they were intellectuals. They went there for a lot of reasons, and if they had other options, they wouldn't have gone to yeshivas. Second of all, because, by the way, it wasn't just those types who were involved in these rebellions. You have to know that Lithuania values above all else intellectual autonomy, free thinking, not free thinking in the sense of secularism or heresy, but just because the Rosh Yeshiva says something, that's no reason to listen to it. I mean, the stories are legendary. If you read some of the stories about how people would come to visiting Rosh Yeshiva, would come to yeshivas, and the students would purposely get together to try to embarrass the person coming in to Rosh Yeshiva, show that he's coming into Slobodka or he's coming into Tells to show us how much he knows. We're going to show him we know more than him. And they would prepare all sorts of difficult kashas on him. These were normal people, and these were kids. These were teenagers. These were people in their 20s with intellectual independence. It's very different than today, in which they try to tell you in B'nai Brak, you know, it's a sort of chassidus they've created. Every Lithuanian Torah scholar had a different personality, and many of them were wild men, literally, in the sense that they couldn't be controlled. They had all sorts of crazy ideas, and nothing would stop them. And we had people like that in America. Ask people about Rav Chaim Zimmerman. I mean, what the Rav was like that to an extent. He would say all sorts of things that they would say. How could he say that? They would battle with each other, and they would Rav Aaron Cutler. I mean, these are people all with their own visions and willing to do all sorts of things. Not in Hebrew, there's an expression, holech batelem, not just going the way people told them to go. Today, how different it is. I'm going to put this in my next blog post. After Rav Yoshev was no longer able to function, Rav Chaim Kanievsky, like the Pope here, like declaring, you know, all we're missing is the white smoke going out. He declares that the torch has now been passed, and now Rav Steinman is the leader, is the Pope. And everyone has to follow him. You never had anything like this before in history. You never made an announcement. No one could announce that this guy is going to be the gadol or this rav is going to take over. The people decided. And by the way, you could have great gadolim. We've had great gadolim. But if the people didn't follow them, then they were great rabbis, great talmidei chachamim, but they had no influence. Those of you from Boston will remember Rav Savitsky. Gon on mufak. I mean, it's gon shebagonim. And yet he never had any influence or anything, because the people decide. It doesn't come from top down. This isn't a church where someone can tell us who to follow. And that's how it always was in the Lithuanian world. If you know the history of the Rugachever, of the Aderis, of Rav Cook, I mean, this is what Lithuania created. It created people like this, the Svidijaš, the altar of Slobodka. There's a reason why it's so interesting. And that's the point of Kamenetsky's book. The point of Kamenetsky's book is to show you that the Lithuanian Torah greats all had personalities. They were all different people. That's what made them special, and that's what allowed them to create what they created. So, and it all started in the yeshivas. Whether they're reading Haskalah literature or whether in Volozhin, you're dealing with people like Ramosha Mordechai Epstein, Rizal Meltzer, who were in underground Zionist movements. You could ask the same thing, Yisrael. If the Rosh Yeshiva, the Netziv, said it's forbidden to have any political organization, any Zionist organization in the yeshiva, how could all these future Gedolim disagree or go against the Rosh Yeshiva and be part of an underground Zionist movement? We know when Rabbi Reines came to Kovno to speak, various Slobodka students went to hear him. And you could say, well, how? The Rosh Yeshiva forbid it. The Rosh Yeshiva got up and said, the altar said, it's forbidden to go hear Rabbi Reines. You know, we don't go, we have to stay in the yeshiva. And yet the students didn't listen. Today's students, the Rosh Yeshiva says that they listen, because the Lithuanian Bachrim did not listen to the Rosh Yeshiva. They did what they wanted to do. If they were a Zionist, they were a Zionist. If they wanted to do secular studies, they did secular studies. They went to the Rosh Yeshiva because they wanted to learn Torah. But they did not surrender their independence, and they did not surrender their minds. That's not a Lithuanian trait, at least not until about 30 years ago. And Rabbi Soloveitchik, and I'll end with this, he said himself, he doesn't want clones. He doesn't want everyone to agree with him just because he's the Rosh Yeshiva. He wants them to agree with him because they think that what he says is correct. And he was training people to be thinkers. And they all thought that. You know, does anyone know the story about Rav Aaron Kotler? I don't know if it's a true story, but the fact that they tell this story is itself significant, because it also shows the ideology. Ethos. Rav Aaron Kotler used to go every summer to Eretz Yisrael because his father-in-law, Rav Zalman Meltzer, was there. He goes to, he gives a shiur, because it was an Eitz Chaim, and there's a guy in the back of the room sitting with his legs up, basically not showing such respect. And Rav Aaron Kotler comes over after the shiur and says, Kavod HaTorah. You know, this is how you sit with your legs up, like, and supposedly, again, I can't say if the story is true. I find it hard to believe it's true, but the fact that it's told says something. Rav Dov Schwartzman is said to have replied to him, when the Rebbe can present, better chidushi, maybe then I'll have some Kavod HaTorah. And rather than slap him or anything like that, Rav Aaron Kotler liked that spirit and said, I want to make him my son-in-law. It turns out that was a bad thing, because he was very much unfitting for Rav Aaron Kotler's wife, who had a secular education and all that, and he ended up divorcing. By the way, in the new autobiography of Rav Gorin, it mentions that Rav Aaron Kotler wanted him to be his son-in-law. And his father, Rav Gorin's father, was in America, and he investigated the situation and said, it's not for you. And again, this was a more modern woman. After this autobiography appeared, people were a little surprised. How could he say this? He doesn't even mention the name, but it's obvious who he's referring to. Then someone posts online a letter from Rav Aaron Kotler to Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer, in which he's speaking about people for his daughter. Who could be a good chassan for his daughter? And he asks Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer, what about Garunchik? That's Rav Gorin. Rav Gorin actually had a very good relationship with Rav Aaron Kotler. In the biography of Rav Gorin, not the autobiography, the one that published Urim Press, is a picture of the two together. One of these trips to Eretz Yisrael, Rav Gorin brought Rav Aaron Kotler to speak to the soldiers. And Rav Gorin was known as the Eagle of Jerusalem. So it makes sense that Rav Aaron Kotler would want him. By the way, if you read Not Making of a God, I'll talk about Rav Aaron Kotler. I mean, he has one story there where some guy yells out a question. That's what they do in yeshivas. You yell out questions, and he's a redhead, and Rav Aaron makes some comment like, what does the Paraduma have to say about this? When you hear these stories, you wonder sometimes how you could insult Talmidim and things like that. But that's, I know Bill's still with us. He probably remembers Rev Yerucham Gorelick. I never met him, but I love speaking to all his students. There never was a greater character than Rabbi Yerucham Gorelick. In short, Lithuanians, the Lithuanian Torah world produced characters. Rav Chaim Zimmerman used to go watch soccer games. He used to like to watch soccer games. And if I'm not mistaken, Dov Frimmer, maybe Aryeh Frimmer, told me he used to I believe it was one of them, Dolph Rimmer was a student of his, he used to ride around in a convertible. But the stories of these types of figures are endless, these Lithuanian types. Bill says he was told by someone that half of Slobodka went off the derech. I once met one of these guys who went off the derech from Slobodka. I don't know if it's half. There's certainly a large number of them. It's hard to say if it's half. I mean, you see these pictures, you see lots of people that we recognize as being great figures in the future. It's not like you see pictures of these rabbis and like half of them we know are one way and half are the other way. So I don't know if it's half, but it's definitely a high percentage, as well as in not just there, but in Volozhin as well. Oh, Yossi says Rav Shimon Schwab wrote to Rav Baruch Baer. Avraham mentions Ponevez, yes. That's now what you have here in the last 20 years. You have had rebellions in Ponevez, and actually the rebellion in Ponevez is even worse. There was a stabbing in Ponevez. So, except I think it's different. Correct me if I'm wrong, Avraham. I think the Ponevez, I think it's all about power there. I think it's all about control. I don't think it's anyone pretend it's about ideology. It's like today with the Hasidim. You have the two Satmars, you have two Todos Aaron Rebbein, you have Babov. I don't think anyone pretends that this is about ideology like it used to be in the olden days. It's all about power, it's about money and control. On the other hand, in the Litvisha world today, there we're seeing replays of what the Hasidim used to be like. The battle really is, obviously there's always power involved, but I think the battle is a fundamental ideological battle. I think the battle in Ponevez today is simply about who's going to run the show. That's different than what was going on a long time ago. But you're right. I mean, the fact that the students get so rebellious and everything, but remember what they're doing. It's not that they're getting so rebellious. They have allegiance to one Rosh Yeshiva or one Rebbe there, and therefore they act out and are violent against the other side. What we have in Tells is the students, there's only one Rosh Yeshiva, and the students are in rebellion against the one, they don't have anyone on their side. It's the students who have their own side, and they're in rebellion against the yeshiva. And when the yeshiva closed down, they open up their own yeshiva. So I think it is a little different. Yisrael says, it seems Rav Aaron Kohler didn't allow that kind of freedom. No, he didn't. And on my post that I mentioned, that the one I dealt with tells that Ner Yisrael is much more a continuation. That is, what they tried to achieve in Ner Yisrael is much more a continuation of the classic Lithuanian society than Lakewood or B'nai Brak. That is, if you look at what Lithuanian Torah society was like, Rav Aaron Kohler was viewed as an extremist even in Lithuania. He's one of the two people, I don't know if there's any others, Hapardes, which covered the Marienbad conference, and they speak about the vote, which was in favor of accepting a state, supporting the creation of a state of Israel. There were others who opposed it, I'm sure, but the two important ones who are mentioned opposing it were Avraham Kohler and Rohanan Wasserman. So even in Europe, and in my post, that same post I keep referring to, take a look at it, I give a story there where Avraham Kohler expelled someone from his yeshiva because this person was going to go to Eretz Yisrael and go to Merkaz to study with Rav Kook. So what did the person do? He moved into Rav Zalman Meltzer's house. I mean, Avraham Kohler was known as a Kanaian extremist in Lithuania, and he came to America. I mean, he went up against more moderate Rosh Yeshiva. He stopped a proposed college that Raputner wanted to create. And that's his great success story, that you would have thought, if you looked in 1940, what type of Haredi orthodoxy would succeed, you would not think it would be Lakewood. And I think to a certain extent, it's the personality of Rav Aaron Kohler that really, he had a... Okay, I want to stop now. Oh, I see that we're down the bottom anyway. Okay, if there's any other comments or questions, please send it to me, and I'll start with them next class. So we finished class number 4. Those who are in the New York area, I'm speaking this Sunday night at the Sprecher's house in Flatbush on the issue of rabbinic biographies, the tension, I think we co-titled it, between historical truth and reverence. So if anyone's in the area and is interested in coming, I look forward to seeing you there. Otherwise, I will see you, we're halfway through. I'll see you next week. Good night, everyone.